This is the Scandal of Reading podcast. Join Jessica Houghton Wilson, author of The Scandal of Holiness, and her co-hosts, Claude Acho, author of Reading Black Books, and Austin Carty, author of The Pastor's Bookshelf, for inspiring conversations about why Christians should be reading great literature. In each episode, the host will also be dialoguing with writers about books they love and why these books matter for the life of the believer.
I am excited to hear y'all's thoughts on this. This is a key question, I think, for readers, and it's one that I circle back to sometimes, and sometimes I'm not actually quite sure what I think about this question, so this will be interesting. How do you determine if a novel is good, and there's some air quotes there, how do you determine if a novel is good morally and stylistically?
Yeah, I get asked this a lot. And the, you know, part of the question is whether those end up becoming the same thing or not.
Yeah.
Because if a novel is poor stylistically, are you being so affected by the form that the content can't overwrite it? Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. 100% it does. And for me, while I can appreciate kind of the postmodern approach to novel writing, I don't tend to recommend really experimental novels.
That's debatable.
Yeah, no, it's certainly debatable. And it's not that I haven't had experimental, more kind of postmodern inflected novels that have meant a lot to me. But when I'm just recommending books to most folks that ask me for a book, I feel that we're still, most of us, so formed in kind of a linear way of thinking, for better or for worse, that more experimental form can be almost a non-starter for people that I'm trying to initiate into a deeper love for reading. That's not 100% the case, but most folks I know of that haven't done a lot of reading within the church, if you point them directly to a book that's really playing with the form to where it's just so all over the place, I've had them come back and say, you know, I couldn't get anywhere with that book, and have never come back and asked for another one.
I wonder if that's the case of those novels just not being strong in the form. So, for example, I'm thinking of things like Loris or, you know, the Holy Fool story by Vodoloshkin, or Godric by Frederick Buechner, that are purposefully messing with linear time to get you to think more about eternal time. So the entire experience of the novel wants to throw you off, because to be thrown off is to move, like to ascend in your ways of thinking about time. Whereas so much of us forget that time is a creation, forget that time is a created thing, that it's not the world that we're actually made for. We're made for a world outside of time, and you need fiction to make you uncomfortable. Now, that might mean that like people have to have a guide towards something that is that good. So I'm not talking about novels that are just, they have no meaning behind it, and they're trying for this kind of originality where they just throw you off and they're experimental to be experimental. Like there's not a higher meaning behind the experiment, because that to me isn't good. But if there's meaning behind the experiment, right, then that can be a stylistic good that's also a moral good.
Yeah. I think a lot of people actually are attracted to experimental form in reading. Like it's sort of this novel, you know, this new thing. So it's sort of a, cause sometimes can be a gimmick. But when I think about, you know, is a novel good stylistically, I usually get really pragmatic, and maybe it's related to the sort of form question too, where it's like anything that like pulls me out of the story and that sort of alerts me to like the fact that, oh, this is, you know, I'm not immersed in the world. Like if I read a sentence and I just think to myself, I maybe could have written a better sentence than that. Then I know there's a problem. And I think maybe related to form, if it's just so bizarre and confusing, and maybe to use your term, Jessica, feels purposelessness. Okay. Like it just has no, like this is not happening for any reason. Then to me, it's like, how can this be good? Because it doesn't even work. Like it's not leading me up to anything. It's just like, it just happened. So I think about that. I also, I've mentioned, I think, in some of our other conversations, my enjoyment of Richard Wright, an author whose novels are, you know, really brutal and kind of very violent. But I think there's a purpose. There's purpose that's happening there. It's not just sort of these depictions for the sake of these depictions. That's another thing that I think about. Like, there was a popular novel called The Magicians, I think, by maybe Lev Grossman is the author's name.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
I think it became a TV show. And it's sort of like pitched as Harry Potter for adults. And I remember reading the first one and just thinking, this is a different, I read Richard Wright and I was like, I can't handle this stuff. Like, there's just something different about this, the way this novel is dealing with these like kind of human brokenness that feels, that almost feels like it's enjoying it. I don't know. And so I can't quite put, I wondered how do you all deal with that sort of question? Like, how do you deal with the sort of the subject matter and the kind of the morality piece? I'm sure that's something people ask you all the time.
Yeah. If Austin, I definitely want you to comment, but I'm going to just jump in because I'm thinking of something specific based on what you just said with Wright. When I used to read Morrison, I felt the way that you just explained about Grossman.
Oh, interesting.
So much about her perspective and experience and worldview that I didn't understand, that she made me uncomfortable. So when I used to teach Beloved, it was actually the novel I struggled the most to teach in a Southern Lit course, because I'm like, I just don't understand it. And it feels really dark and it feels really horrible. And I hate any story that talks about children dying, like Dante, I don't care what story it is. Children dying is really hard for me in fiction. It just is very visceral. And so that novel, I couldn't teach. I taught it over and over again, but I was struggling with it. And I would say only in the last 5 or 6 years, maybe, that I have changed my way of reading her. And I know it's been informed by nonfiction, right? Like reading The Cross and the Lynching Tree, reading Jesus and the Disinherited, you know, reading a lot of books, nonfiction, that helped me understand Morrison's fiction. And then I could see the purpose behind it. Whereas just the reading experience, I was missing it.
So we continue to return to purpose, right? And being able to discern that and sense that in the reading. Yeah, Austin, what are your thoughts?
Well, yeah, I love this whole conversation because I'm thinking of it on two levels. You know, and the first question, as I kind of answered it, it was on the level of thinking about the individual person you're talking to that you're recommending a book to. Mm-hmm. And where they are kind of in their reading journey and what you kind of sense they're looking for. I think those are important elements in how we answer this question. But then similarly then is the other level of just in general, you know, what makes for, in our opinion, you know, a stylistically effective novel, which is different than what is somebody at their kind of stage in reading going to, you know, take to. And so then the question of what makes for, you know, just an effective and good kind of moral novel. I think that here, a lot of this for me is about reading with a charitable spirit, because there are lots of things that if we're hopefully curious readers, we're going to read that, to your point, Jessica, because of our own lived experience, we're going to be reading outside of our own to where we're just going to feel disoriented. We don't have our moorings. And so I do think that the posture toward which we as readers come to a book helps us answer this question, because something that could seem obscene or immoral might not be obscene or immoral, or something that feels threatening might not be something threatening. It might be something that we really need, but that we're just not ourselves yet, you know, braced and prepared to fully be able to appreciate. And if we're reading without a charitable spirit, we just close it and put it away and say it's obscene or threatening or immoral, when probably we ought to interrogate what is that about and were we really kind of open readers for that. And so this touches on something that's very important to me as a pastor when it comes to reading, which is that you can take a risk as a pastor recommending certain books to folks, because different people have an anticipation and expectation for what their pastoral leaders might be reading, what they're going to recommend. And there have been times I've recommended things that have really kind of provoked or troubled people. But I would never do that if I didn't feel like underneath the content that is going to be challenging and troublesome, there's something really important to learn about human nature there, and something that's really important to learn about the lived experience of others, and ultimately underneath all of that, then the complexity of reality, and therefore, you know, the complexity of God's creation. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot in that kind of rambling answer I gave, but I do want to underscore in it that there's a question of what is kind of objectively moral and what's not. But that has to always be in dialogue with the question of subjectively, what kind of a spirit and openness, you know, am I bringing as a reader to the book in question?
Yeah, I would totally agree. I think it has a lot to do with the virtue of the reader to be able to see what's good. At the same time, I love the question because I think we're getting at something about purpose. Because even Austin, you said, if the reader is virtuous and charitable, but is still troubled by the work, then you get to assess, is the troubling, in the case for Claude with Grossman, not purposeful? Or is the troubling, as it was my case with Morrison, purposeful, and I need to go through that scandal, as the, you know, the way the New Testament sometimes uses the word, and the way I use the word is, it scandalized me into a better way of reading.
Yeah, that is a good last word and a really rich conversation. I've been helped by this, and insightful. Stay tuned for a insightful and good interview.
This podcast is sponsored by Brazos Press. Brazos Press publishes books that creatively draw upon the riches of the Christian story to deepen our understanding of God's world and inspire faithful reflection and engagement. A Brazos Press book that I recommend is The Making of Biblical Womanhood, How the Subjugation of Women Became Gospel Truth by Beth Allison Barr. In the book, Barr shows that the biblical womanhood isn't biblical, but was born in a clearly definable historical moment, and she presents a better way forward for the contemporary church. Get 30% off and free shipping at bakerbookhouse.com.
Welcome to the Scandal of Reading podcast. I am eager to talk this morning with Mary McCampbell, who is the author of Imagining Our Neighbors as Ourself. Just to completely give away my bias, I actually endorsed the book. So I wanted to have this conversation, not just about Mary's book, but also about one of the books that she talks about in here, because we both wrote on Graham Greene's The Power and the Glory. And so I thought she'd be a great person to kind of bring along with us as we talk about this novel. So I want to start first and ask Mary, would you please introduce yourself to listeners who may not be familiar with your work?
Yes, thank you, Jessica. I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for having me. And I am Associate Professor of Humanities at Lee University in Cleveland, Tennessee, not Ohio. And this is my 13th year there, I think. And yes, I just, book came out in April, and I mean, mainly I wanted to write this book because of the conversations I was having with students in the classroom and seeing how much their close reading and their close engagement with the arts could really help them to become more empathetic. And of course, I've also seen that a lot in my life too. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, but my area of specialization, I did my doctorate in Newcastle in the UK, and my area of specialization tends to be kind of contemporary literature, very contemporary literature. My focus was on the author Douglas Copeland, mm-hmm. but contemporary literature and theology and theory, you know, kind of those things all together. And so I do tend to teach a lot of both contemporary literature, but I'm also very interdisciplinary. Mm-hmm. So I really love, you know, also teaching film and popular culture and music. I like to see all these things work together. So interestingly, The Power and the Glory, although I love 20th century literature, but I tend to write more on much more contemporary mm-hmm. literature, you know, since like 1980. Right. But it's still, you know, my favorite novel is Jane Eyre, and that was nowhere near a novel. But it's just like, you know, if you, you know how it is, if you love literature, you love literature.
Right.
You have sometimes area that, you know, I'm very driven to contemporary lit, just because I'm very curious about wanting to understand how contemporary thinkers, you know, understand the religious impulse about it, especially coming from non-Christians. But yeah, Graham Greene, you know.
Well, yeah. What drew you to Greene? I mean, I know my own story. In graduate school, I was studying Catholic literature, so my of course, I'm going to come across Greene, and we were doing it across the world. So it was Bernanos and Mauriac, and then Greene and Waugh. I mean, primarily men, and I'm just now discovering that there's actually a lot of Catholic women writers that I didn't get to read when I was studying the 20th century. But I think that I read it so much as an academic book, you know, because it was assigned, that I didn't really get to the heart of it until I read it again on my own as part of a women's book club. It was being led by well-read moms, and I'm reading this from a completely different place, and I fell in love with it. I don't know what your experience was for reading the novel.
I never read any Greene in college or graduate school ever. But I'd heard, actually the first, what drew me to this novel was, I used to help organize this wonderful gathering called the Festival of Faith and Music, not the writing one, but the music one.
Okay.
At Calvin, you know, because I taught there a few years, and then I just kept, even after I left, I kept working with it. And one year, I think it was Greg Wolfe spoke, and he quoted, you know, the very famous quote from here about hate being a failure of imagination.
Yes.
I don't know, that really captured me, and I really was so drawn. So I sort of read the novel because I heard the quote.
Wow. Okay.
I wanted to know. And then Greene in general, I teach a class on the Christian imagination, and I don't know how, somehow I chose The End of the Affair, which I think I might like even better than
Yes, it's
novel.
Really good.
I love that one. And I've taught that one a few times.
Yeah. It's gorgeous.
So yeah. That's really, yeah, but my first entry into Greene, I mean, I've had friends who really like him, but I've never had not read, but it was only about, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago that I actually picked up some of his writing. So,
well, and you actually start with that quote. I'm going to give the longer version of it, but your book begins with Greene's quote. The quote begins, "When you visualized a man or woman carefully, you could always begin to feel pity. That was a quality God's image carried with it. When you saw the lines at the corner of the eyes, the shape of the mouth, how the hair grew, it was impossible to hate. Hate was just a failure of the imagination." Would you be willing to maybe set up the scene where the priest makes this observation and then talk about why you started your work this way?
Yes. I mean, I would want to say, well, the power and the glory is set. I'm terrible with dates, Jessica. What's the time period?
It's written in the 1940s, and Greene was actually researching the Catholic persecution of the 1930s.
Yeah. So, but what were the date, like in the 20s, 30s?
I thought it was the 30s, the early 30s. So it was around, yeah, because he was researching there, and he was going to do a journalistic piece on it. And then it turned into this 1940 novel, but he was researching during the 30s.
Yeah, I knew that it was written in the 40s, but I couldn't remember the exact dates of the persecution because, yeah, this is the side of me that I don't remember those things. Yes, it's a time period, you know, in Mexican history when Catholicism was basically outlawed, punishable by death. And if you were a priest, you either had to leave the country or assimilate, which there's another priest in the book, Father Jose, who assimilates, you know, marries, has a family, gives up his faith, or, you know, you have to renounce your faith, or do what the central character in the novel, who has no name, but we call him the whiskey priest, does. You go underground.
Yes.
But there's so the whole novel, you know, he's underground. He's doing these saying illegal mass. mm-hmm. you know, hearing a legal confession. But at this point, he is in a prison cell. And it's ironic because he wasn't arrested for being a priest. They still didn't know he was a priest. He was arrested for having, was it some sort of illegal brandy?
Right, he had brandy, yeah.
And, yeah, so, excuse me. And he's in the prison cell, and he encounters this pious woman. That's the way she's described. And I was going to find it. Green writes, he had always been worried by the fate of pious women. As much as politicians, they fed on illusion. And he goes on and talking about, you know, how pious women. And it really makes you think of Flannery O'Connor and her critique of this kind of religiosity. And so there's this pious woman who, again, is just very judgmental and self-righteous and mean.
Yes, but she's in prison.
She's in prison. I know, she's in prison. But she tells him, she's listening to him and she's judging him. And she's at one point, she knows he's an alcoholic. She knows, you know, all of this these problems. And she says, it'd be the sooner you're dead, the better.
Yeah.
Like, we don't need any priests like you. And I think he says this in his mind because anyone's knee-jerk reaction to that would be to bite back, you know, or to just hate her, or just, mm-hmm. you know, somebody tells you, I want you to die.
Right.
But he pauses and he notices the image of God in her. Mm-hmm. And then he begins to pity her. And then he actually says he's responsible for her. And that's also where it reminds me a lot of O'Connor, like a good man is hard to find at the end when mm-hmm. the grandmother realizes she's responsible for the misfit.
Yeah.
So it's that very, very difficult empathy mm-hmm. that drew me in.
Yeah. Well, that's a Dostoevskian idea, that they're both really influenced by Dostoevsky, because in The Brothers Karamazov, the father's Zosima says we're responsible for all. And that kind of mentality, I think, was life altering for both Green and for O'Connor, this idea that we're responsible for all.
Yeah.
What does that mean? Yeah. And yet we have this character who is a wretch. I mean, we call him the whiskey priest. He doesn't actually have a name that differentiates him from other priests. The only key thing we know about him is that he drinks too much. He cares too much about the things of this world. He's constantly out for his own skin and himself. I mean, he wants to board the boat to get away, but he does go when he hears that someone needs him. And when there is a role for the priest to play, he does obey his vocation. So why do you think
I said he goes, but he hates it. He's like resisting. Yeah. He just.
Yeah. I keep saying like unvolitionally, unwillingly, like he's, you know, he's always being drawn a kind of against his lusts and desires for his own life and his own good, but he keeps doing it.
Yeah.
You know, there's this faithfulness even in the midst of his sin, but maybe I'm getting ahead of myself. but why do you think that Green creates him this way? Like, he could have created a good saint. We could have watched a completely different story and witnessed a character who showed a holy foolishness or a good faith. Like, why do we have the whiskey priest instead?
Yeah, I think that's, well, I'm also think in relating to that, I'm thinking about how much he was influenced by Shisako Endo.
Yeah.
No, Shisako Endo was influenced by him. Sorry about that.
Other
direction. Never mind.
Yeah.
I was going to say how interesting that is. That's a whole side note, though, that you see Shisako Endo doing very similar things in Silence. But I feel like there's something so human, of course, about the whiskey priest. Mm-hmm. And of course, also it's important to mention that he has a daughter. He has an illegitimate mm-hmm. child that, you know, so that's another bad. Mm-hmm. And he feels guilty because he doesn't even regret that he has the daughter because he loves the daughter. I feel like on some levels, a lot of his theology is actually kind of quite legalistic mm-hmm. in some of his way of thinking. But yeah, I think what Green is showing us is this is a man who does not check the boxes of what a priest should be, or a saint, or any kind of Christian trying to live the life of Christ, trying to be holy. At the same time, he has such empathy, and he continually goes back to how important it is to see the image of God in other people. Mm-hmm. He does have that pity. Yeah, I feel like, well, there was a description in here, and now I have all these pages marked, but I don't know which is which. But I remember in one part, it talks about the pendulum swing inside mm-hmm. of him. Mm-hmm. And I feel like he really is a picture of, we don't do the things we want to do. We do the things that we hate.
Yes.
But interestingly with him, it's almost like, well, he doesn't even necessarily want to do these things. Like he wants to be holy, but he's so drawn the other direction. So I think he's so interesting because he is so overtly sinful, and he's very honest about his sinfulness.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, he seems to have gifting, and he seems to have priestly gifting.
Right.
You know, he seems to have gifting of really seeing the glory and the wretchedness of other human beings, and being able to love them even against his own will. So I don't know, he's a very complicated character.
Right. Well, he reminds me so much of Old Testament characters, because, or even I probably could draw some analogies with the New Testament apostles too, but with the Old Testament characters, you have all of these horrible judges that God keeps calling, and yet God does amazing things through them, right? So, I mean, you just, Gideon is the worst. Samson, I mean, none of them are good. Samson and Delilah, I mean, the whole story is about he keeps sleeping with the enemy. Like, it's just, and so when it comes to this understanding of what God is doing in the world and through people, I think too often what Green was seeing or trying to point out to us is that we focus on moralistic. We focus on those kind of, the piety that the woman in prison expects.
Yes.
And we want that kind of fake moralism to say what belief is, but belief is that no matter how bad you are, the Lord can do something amazing through you.
Yes.
Right. And so I think that that's what the priest witnesses to us, is this same idea. And also he's a different priest from before the persecution to after it. Don't you think?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's like anything that gave him a semblance, like if he was going to hinge his identity on being a priest, and if that meant all the social attachments mm-hmm. and all of the public righteous attachments, all of those things have been torn away. And there's something amazing that, like, why does this man, he could so easily renounce his faith and get mm-hmm. married. He could leave the country, but he keeps hanging on because he feels that he has been called to do this.
Yes.
As much as he doesn't even like it most of the time. And there's something really, I mean, he's heroic in spite of himself.
Yes. Yes. So, because of obedience, not because of his own virtue. And I think of Paul, that's why I was going to draw this New Testament reference too. When you imagine Paul, there's so much heroism that we focus on in his later years. But when you go back to who he was as Saul, it's kind of like the whiskey priest pre-persecution.
Mm.
There was a place of esteem. He had, you know, all of the, he talks about this, right, in the letters, in which he had all of the markers of being a good Jew. He was a great Pharisee. He followed the law. He was the best of the best. It was a performative faith, and he excelled at it. And he made it to the top, even to the point where, like the lieutenant in Graham Greene's novel, he was willing to persecute in order to save the church, right? To save what he thought was right. He was willing to do violence, right? And allow, you know, Stephen to be martyred, to go into people's homes, to arrest Christians. And it's not until Christ calls him to suffer for his name.
Mm.
That's the call that the Lord gives Ananias when it comes to Paul, is, I want you to teach him how much he will suffer for my name. And that's what happens to the whiskey priest. He has a place of power and prestige in the community. The persecution comes, and he learns how much he must suffer for Christ's name. And it makes him into a different person.
Yeah. Yes, it does.
Because
I'm just thinking about, I mean, it's probably not good to go so far to the end already, but I'm just think I'm just, there's a one quote that to me relates so much to what we're both saying. It's right at the end where he's about to, I mean, spoiler alert, it's kind of an old book, but he's going to be finally he gets caught and he's going to be executed. And of course he doesn't ever feel worthy of these things, being a martyr. But at the end, he talks about, he saw his own shadow in the, on the wall. And he says he felt only an immense disappointment because he had to go to God empty handed with nothing done at all. And I wrote down, you know, in my notes, but don't we all? You know, isn't that the point, that he can't make himself into a saint? You know, he, like the idea that at the end, his final revelation, which he thinks is a failure, is I'm going to God empty handed with nothing to show.
Right, right. And it's it's actually the greatest act of humility that he exhibits over the course of the whole novel. I think it's one of the only indications that he could be holy, is that moment where he feels like a failure because he's empty handed. It's an acknowledgement of his nothingness.
Yes.
It's just so beautiful. George Bernanos, right? The Diary of a Country Priest. That priest says, "Oh, miracle of empty hands, that we are able to give what we ourselves do not possess."
Wow.
And that, so, and, you know, of course, Green is really influenced by Bernanos, this idea of the empty handedness. He turns into a different image with the whiskey priest, seeing it as a failure, as you put it. Right.
Yes.
So he recognizes the necessity of being a saint.
And well, but the thing is that at the end here, when he says that, and I guess that's where you said the act of the most humility is that he doesn't even recognize. I mean, to me, that's still sad, because it's like he doesn't even recognize, but that's exactly where you need to be. Like, we recognize it, but does he actually recognize it?
Yeah.
He just thinks, oh, you know, I've blown it.
Right.
But we think, no, no, that's, isn't this the point of the whole book? Isn't this, isn't this what we're supposed to understand? So,
well, and that, but I think that's the beauty. This is what I talk about with Flannery O'Connor all the time. You mentioned a good man is hard to find. That moment at the end where the grandmother reaches out her hand, she has the revelation. She has the reality. I'm responsible for you. I've made you what you are. And then she falls into the ditch in this like cruciform posture, but she's dead. Mm-hmm. And everyone laments the ending of this novel because she dies right at the moment she has this epiphany about God. But O'Connor is challenging us to, do we actually believe in her revelation? Do we believe that that's right, that that's truth, that that's the answer? That's the same question that's being posed to us, that, right? I mean, we witness his martyrdom. Do we believe that the only thing in life is to be a saint, the same epiphany that he has, and that we have to come to that with empty hands, right? Yeah, it's the effect on the reader.
Yeah, I mean, and that makes me think of it in Good Man is Hard to Find, when she's over in the ditch after she's been shot, and it says she looks up and she looks like a child.
Yes.
And you think about, it's that moment of, I mean, yeah, a kind of rebirth, or kind of, you know, she has, she's in a state of kind of almost childlike wonder. It's not innocence, but it's a point of, I have nothing to give. It's just a point of being stripped bare. Well, as the misfit says, you know, she'd been a good woman if there's someone there to shoot her every day of her life. Yeah. So maybe with the whiskey priest, he'd be a good man if there was someone there to.
And that's what happens. He finally becomes a good man, because every day of his life during the persecution, those are the days where a gun is always aimed at him.
Yes.
And only when the gun is aimed at him in those final days does he move from being this fat, lustful, alcoholic priest to someone who actually desires the love of God and desires the life of sanctity, right? It's a complete transition for him.
That's right? So interesting. It makes me think of a John Donne poem. And now I can't remember. Of course, they don't have names. It's just Holy Sonnet number something. but I remember it because the Welcome Wagon do a version of it, a song. And the line that Vito in the song repeats over and over is, "Those are my best days when I'm shake with fear."
Oh, yeah.
And that, you know, that it's the fear. I mean, he's talking about the fear of the Lord,
right? You
know, realizing your unworthiness. And are those the best days?
Oh, okay. I have to read that passage where he talks about the fear of the Lord. Then the priest is in that conversation with the lieutenant.
Yes.
And he's finally been caught and they're having that dialogue and they're having it out about who's right. And the lieutenant sounds very much like Dostoevsky's Grand Inquisitor. I think that. But the priest says, God is love, but we wouldn't recognize that love. It might even look like hate. It would be enough to scare us, God's love. It set fire to a bush in the desert, didn't it? And smashed open graves and set the dead walking in the dark. Oh, a man like me would run a mile to get away if he felt that love around. Mm. Oh, doesn't it just give you chills?
Yes.
Right? It's a fearful, like fear and trembling kind of love that he... Yes. has been experiencing, that he is able to then put before the lieutenant in a way that we saw him preach earlier in the novel, and he was horrible at preaching. You know, he didn't know what he was talking about. And now, without even trying, his honest perspective on who God is relaying the truth. Finally, yeah. You can see. And he talks earlier about not having the eyes of a saint, but here we get to hear this vision. He's like, oh, he finally has the eyes of a saint.
Yeah, and he's very persistent in holding. He talks about, I don't know, earlier in the novel, he says he feels like he only has the little outlines of the mystery because he's not connected to any of the schooling and the books and all the education, mm-hmm. but he just sees the shadowy outline. Again, O'Connor, what's the shadowy man jumping in the back of your head? Right. But the shadowy outline, I can't remember the way he says it, but... Yeah, it's almost like the more he gets away from the way he's supposed to be, according to the outline of, you know, a priest.
Right.
It's like the more he's not dependent on his own actions and his own education.
Right.
That. But then I love that about the love of God. Can you just read that last part again? Because that's so beautiful. I remember the first time I read that I was just like, oh, I have to pause a minute.
It would be enough to scare us, God's love. It set fire to a bush in the desert, didn't it? And smashed open graves and set the dead walking in the dark. Oh, a man like me would run a mile to get away if he felt that love around. Yeah,
exactly. The fear of God, like he knows his unworthiness.
Yes.
So different than the priest who feels like they, you know, have everything under control. Yeah.
It brings a whole new perspective to the Christ haunting that is so prevalent in the South. This is a completely different idea of Christ haunting you, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think he becomes a saint at the end? I know Green is trying to show that he could. I mean, he's trying to show all these miracles. And Green does this in the end of the affair too, right? He tries to show the character had miracles. The character did things that would allow them to be canonized.
Yeah. I don't know. And I mean, the question is, you know, does it matter?
Right.
I think that in the end he is saved. I don't know if he means he's a saint or by that, you know, because of sainthood has to do with, you know, holiness of life. Mm-hmm. And what does that even mean? Right. And so maybe Graham Greene is redefining what a holy life looks like. It's not what you do necessarily. Well, I don't know. It's not, you know, doing the right things. It's knowing your unworthiness, knowing, you know, knowing, as Pascal would say, knowing your wretchedness.
Mm.
I mean, this is a character very in touch with his own wretchedness.
Yes.
To the point of despair a lot, you know, so I don't know what to think about that. What do you think?
But despair that doesn't like hinder him from becoming faithful or staying faithful.
Yes.
I think that's the important part, is to become aware of your wretchedness, but also aware of God's holiness. Because if you have awareness of both of those things, then you know through God's holiness, your wretchedness has meaning.
Yes. Yeah. That's what I think Pascal says, knowing God without knowing your wretchedness leads to pride.
Mm.
And knowing your wretchedness without knowing God leads to despair.
Yes, there you go. That's so great.
That's what's, he know, like he never doubts the existence of God, does he? Never doubts his unworthy. It's like this is just the way, this is the order of the universe and his place in it, and he knows his unworthiness.
Right.
What he doubts is himself and his abilities. But do you think he became a saint?
I do, but I think that's Green's intention. But also, you know, like you said, does it matter? It's kind of like when you get to the end of an O'Connor story too. The question isn't whether the character becomes holy or becomes a saint or is saved. The question is, have you yourself grown in sanctity by reading this story, right? Have you glimpsed who God is and how to love your neighbor through reading this story? And those are the things that to me matter most. I mean, when I wrote on this, I was writing for a desire for holiness that I found when I was reading this. It made me desire holiness more.
Yes.
Which I think is the point.
But do we think though that Green, because you know, Green was quite a rascal in his own life. and I'm just, I mean, he was. The end of the affair is pretty autobiographical, isn't it? And so I'm thinking, is this a way, is he kind of, you know, in a way, it's to we just ignore all the priest's sins?
Mm-hmm.
If a life of holiness, it isn't just, oh, well, I know I'm unworthy, so I'll go ahead and do all these terrible things.
Right.
You know, but I don't know, the priest doesn't necessarily do that.
He's actually unholy before the persecution, and he moves through the suffering and persecution to become holy. It's those things which change him. They actually keep him from doing, you know, he's addicted to alcohol, but they keep him from a lot of the sins he experienced when he was a fat, happy priest.
Yeah. And it's so interesting to me that he feels guilty for loving his own child because he feels like he should see her and realize she's a result of sin, yet he feel, and again, this is a kind of weird theology, legalism. He feels, you know, shouldn't I not want to love her and not want to? So it's really interesting that even some of his very sins lead to things that are really beautiful.
Yeah.
Like his child, and we see a real love for his child.
Right.
That I think does seem to have changed him. So that's also another aspect.
Yeah. No, I think that I do think he is called to holy acts that are done in spite of himself. But I don't think that it is permitting him to keep on sinning. I think that actually is a change, mm-hmm. a way that he transforms over the course of the novels, that he's moving from sin to love. And he did live a very sinful life. But your questions that you're bringing up are the same questions that the Vatican had when they came into the novel, when it came out, was like, are we just saying that all priests are bad and that it doesn't matter what you do and you can keep on sinning and then you get to be a saint at the end? Like, there were the same kind of questions, but I think all great books give us those questions. It's not going to be, you have to wrestle with it. If you're not wrestling with it, I don't know how good of a book it is.
Yeah. I mean, again, looking at new, you know, figures in the New Testament, you know, looking at Matthew, the tax collector, and I mean, figures that I'm sure many around would be like, him?
You're right.
Now, of course, they did renounce their life of sin and follow Jesus, you know, different. And we don't see such a straight path. Although, look at Peter. Well, he was a mess, which I love, because it's that pendulum swing of humanity. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that, would an actual saint be this kind of airbrushed, perfect, you know, figure?
I think it's the reality. I think the novel's able to tell the truth even better. I mean, I've argued better than hagiographies do.
Yeah, that's a great. I think one part, I just saw this because I'm so interested in the kind of empathy aspect.
Right.
That when he, I think one of his, quote, saving graces, what you just see that the good parts of his theology have really penetrated his entire being, and have you know, have provided a way by which he sees the world. And because, you know, there's that the character, the mestizo, that he just knows, he says, is Judas. This is a character that's following him around that he knows is there to turn him in and betray him. And he can't stand this man, but he feels like, I'm called to love him.
Yes.
I'm called to see the image of God even in him. And there's this quote says, but at the center of his own faith, there always stood the convincing mystery that we were made in God's image. And he says, and he even talked about how impossible it was to deface. You know, he's talking, there's this one part here about how smashing art images of God, but you couldn't actually ever really deface or smash the image of God mm-hmm. because this is a living part of a human being. And I mean, it's just so, again, but this is the whiskey priest, this is the messed up guy, and he's yeah. saying his thoughts, you really get in his thoughts, taking to this deep well mm-hmm. of true belief and true love.
Right.
Because love, you know, I think he's also showing us that love is kind of an action. Like sometimes you have to force yourself to love. It's not just an easy, fuzzy feeling. It's not yeah. just, oh, I, you know, I love who I feel like loving.
Right. Right. Well, you know, I was talking to a friend yesterday because she was dealing with some idiots in her department, and she, you know, she's the only woman in an all male department. And they were just saying things they shouldn't be saying. And she's like, how much crap do I put up with? And, how much do I have to keep putting up with before, you know, I just throw it all in and leave this job and write my resignation letter. And, you know, I'm not perfect in responding to those issues. I have no idea what I would do in different situations. But at the same time, I did remind her, you know, even when you look at stories of Holocaust or persecution, it's amazing to me that the saints prayed for their persecutors, that they prayed for the people that were hurting them because God could be doing something. So when you were talking about Mestizo and the fact that the saint knows, or whiskey priest knows, that this guy is going to do him wrong, that this person is going to end up hurting him. And yet he still tries to help him and love him and pray for him. Like, how much then is God just calling us to love the idiots that are giving us a hard time that we feel like it is difficult to put up with these people?
Yes. In order for him, and this is where his imagination is so important, hate being a failure, is that he's actively working to see God's image in another human being. God's mm-hmm. image is something, who of us can really describe what that even looks like? What is that about? You know, I mean, we know we could sit here and give a list of right. what it means that we're made in God's image. You know, we have reason, we have emotions, we have all of these things, but all together it's a mystery. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he has this imagination to always seek the mystery.
Yes.
Yeah. Is really amazing and a hard thing to do.
Well, it's, you know, just to plug your book as we close, like, it is definitely the reason you wrote your book, right? Yeah. Is to train people to have that kind of imagination where hate is not the only option, but love is a real possibility.
Yes.
So
again, it's a hard thing. This is the hardest, I think, the love of enemies, very hard part. So. Yeah.
Well, thank you for that good word, and thank you for talking about green this morning with me, and I hope people go out and get a copy of your book.
Oh, thank you so much. It was a real pleasure.